All right, are we ready to start in a minute, Dr. Mark?
I'm ready.
Okay, all right, so we're going, I guess, part five. Welcome, everybody. And once again, I want to thank the Sasson family sponsoring Jacob and Joseph sponsoring in memory of their father, Albert Avram Ben-Sala. I should have long life, good memories, and thank you very much. And okay, we'll hear the backlash to Rav Gorin. I think that's this week's topic.
Yes, okay. Today I'll do that, and I think my next class we'll get into Rav Gorin's his book. We'll start going through it, his halachic argument, and that'll get us into the really into the deep understanding, hopefully. But a few comments, as always. I listened to the class, and I started thinking. So I checked. I said the Dakar submarine, that famous story, was it left France? I thought actually it left Gibraltar. That's the. Purchased it from England and it left Gibraltar, so that's that. Now, and it sunk near Cyprus. I want to get back to something 2 weeks ago. I don't know if Charlie's with us now, but we spoke about the cooking and non-Jews cooking for an old people in an old age home on Shabbos. And I mentioned the Rabbi Apfel of Leeds and the case with Rabbi Toledano in England. I didn't say it exactly. The opinion I attributed to Rav Toledano was Rabbi Apfel. So basically, the case is you have an old age home in England, and could you cook for them on Shabbos, the old people? Rabbi Apfel wanted to argue that they're old, so it's they have the status of a chola. I also made a mistake. I said chola sheyesh bo sakana. That's not actually what's needed. It doesn't have to be a chola sheyesh bo sakana. Let me show you here. Hold on, it could be even a whole like she'ein bo sakana. Here is the Rambam, and the Shulchan Aruch says the same thing. Hello, this is let's see, it's Shabbos Perek Beis 2 Halacha Yud. When a sick person is not dangerously ill, all his needs should be cared for by a Gentile. We may tell a Gentile to perform forbidden labors, etc. It says this includes cooking, baking. So a non-Jew, someone who's a cholesh, ein bo sakana, the non-Jew is allowed to cook for him on Shabbos. So Rabbi Apfel wanted to say, okay, well then we assume that these non-old people have that status. Well, Rabbi Toledano doesn't think so. He doesn't think that every old person has the status of a cholesh. Just because you have difficulty walking or something, which is the case for many, doesn't mean you have the status where you can have a non-Jew cook for them. But it is important because you're in this place, let's say there's no Jewish cooks, and I mean, I don't know why they can't have cholent or something, but whatever it is, that's the case. And Rabbi Toledano makes the argument, which I said last class or two classes ago. That now he wouldn't make this argument for regular people, but in an old age home already, you're at a, even if they're not halachically cholish ein bo sakana, it's a difficult circumstance. Let's put it this way, and he thinks that since the people are hired ahead of time, they're not they're paid to do every day to cook, so they also cook on Shabbos. Charlie said that the OU must agree with this because they do this in a place under their supervision. Now. We raised the question, if you recall, I raised it. Well, then they cook. If you happen to walk in there, can you eat the food? It's already been cooked. And I assumed no. I gave the svara, I thought. And really, I mean, it's very nice to give svaras, but the truth is, had I known the halacha properly, I wouldn't have had to give a svara because it's explicit in the Shulchan Aruch that, where is it here? If one cooked food for a critically ill person is in Shulchan Aruch 318 2. If one cooked food permissibly for an ill person, it's forbidden. And it's, even this is a critically ill person. It's forbidden on Shabbos for a healthy person or even an ill person who's not critically ill to eat that food. So, okay, so svaras are nice, but explicit halachas in the Shulchan Aruch are even nicer. And finally, I just want to share something. because it reminded me of something we did a few weeks ago, if you recalled, about the issue of the issue we've discussed a lot about, people cooking for, I'm sorry, non-hashgacha, Jews having it in, things like that. I'm writing something, a blog post. It should be out soon. And in the blog post, I deal with the Aderis. This is Rav Kook's father-in-law from this first Rav Kook's first marriage. Then Rav Kook's wife died, and he remarried. He remarried the niece of the Aderis. But the Aderis has a sefer which hasn't been published, but sections of it have been published. And in one of these sections, the Aderis discusses a weekend, a Shabbos, where the Chafetz Chaim came to him. And they spent Shabbos together, and he records the different Torah matters they spoke about. Really interesting. And one of the things that the Chafetz Chaim asked the Aderis is, "What about the inns? We're talking Jewish inns where you eat the food there." And he says, Adam. He says that most, we're talking Lithuania here. It's 18, the Aderis is, I think it was 1874 or 1878, his book. So sometime before. So we're talking about inns where most of the people are not careful. They don't tovel their dishes. So what should a, what should someone do when they stay there? Because the Chafetz Chaim is saying you can't eat on, he's assuming that you can't eat on, plates that aren't toveled. And the Aderis's answer, and I think this is pretty much the standard approach, at least in the modern Orthodox world, because if you're going to be medakdeik on this, there's a lot of houses you can't eat because a lot of people don't tovel, that it only is issue on the person themselves. It's not me. If I'm visiting, it doesn't affect me. I can eat what I want, but the person has to tovel his dishes. It doesn't affect, as he says, Ikar Tfilim, he says, is on Rak al Baal HaKli, v'lo acherim. And if he didn't tovel it, Einach Rayos Acherim Alav, v'lo Nesar Acherim Kal. No one else needs to be concerned with that. But before I get to that, that's an interesting point, but I'm more interested here in something else. Jews in Eastern Europe, they're traveling, they're staying at inns. The person is kosher, obviously. They're eating at this inn, but the person doesn't tovel the dishes. Now, remember, we saw that at the hotel. The Aharon Cutler said about bishalakum. From now on, you should do bishalakum, and you should make sure a Jew lights the fire. But until then, they hadn't been. We couldn't imagine today that a restaurant owned by a Jew that the hashgacha would allow it to. Not to have tovel dishes. But the point is that in those days you didn't have hashgachas. You relied on the person. And here you see that it's not a modern thing. Sometimes you hear the rabbis say, make it seem as if it's a modern thing that today people are not toveling dishes. And we see already in the 19th century, I don't know how far back it goes, but already in the 19th century, religious Jews, people who you could eat at their house, nevertheless, they weren't toveling dishes. Now, let me just add one more point, but let's pick up regarding the toveling. I looked around today at various sources on it, and I have to say I'm surprised that I haven't found any poskim who say that today's day and age, there's no real inyan of toveling at all. Again, my svara, but as far as I can see, my svara has not been adopted by anyone. But let me explain the svara. First of all, it's explicit in the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, that if it's owned by a Jew and a non-Jew, it doesn't require toveling. So you have a company, let's say Bloomingdale's. Bloomingdale's, there's shares in it, and every time you buy something, you're buying it from a store. And in all those cases, it's almost all, unless you're getting to a small specialty shop, it's owned by shareholders. And therefore, a Jew has an ownership. And in fact, the Minchas Yitzchak says, Rabbi Weiss says, that if a Jew even owns a tiny bit, you tovel, but you don't tovel with a bracha. Okay, so I'm curious as to why someone just doesn't make the conclusion I'm saying, that don't tovel at all. I mean, it's now Rav Moshe Feinstein says that with big companies and shares, you have to have a significant portion. And if you don't, he thinks you're really not an owner in the way we think about it. Fine. So therefore, if Jews are, but in some of these companies, maybe you do have significant Jewish ownership. But I still think that's an interesting svara. But then I have another svara. If you look at the sources, all the sources before modern times are speaking about something from a non-Jew. So you're tovlud. We understand that. But today you're buying something from a corporation. Now I understand Rav Moshe assumes that the corporation really, if the majority, if the shareholders, the big shareholders are not Jewish, then it's Jewish. Then it's not Jewish. And but if you had even Rav Moshe would say if you had a significant shareholder, I don't know what significant is, who's Jewish, that would you would definitely wouldn't need to tovel, I'm assuming, because it's significant. But why would you have to tovel anyway? We're dealing with corporations. Corporations weren't known in earlier days. A corporation is like an artificial entity. Yes, you do own a share, but it's not. If the corporation goes bankrupt, you yourself personally, you don't. If there's debts, you personally don't pay them. I mean, a corporation is like an independent entity. Is there such a thing as a corporation being over on Chamesh Avar Lava Pesach or something? I mean, it would seem to me at least that I'm surprised that no one has made the case that a corporation isn't a non-Jew. Even if non-Jews are shareholders in it, just as if it's not a Jew, if Jews are shareholders, it seems to me at least that someone should have argued that it's a completely independent entity. And when you buy from Bloomingdale's dishes, just because the majority, that in general, Bloomingdale's has plenty of Jewish shareholders, but this is neither Jewish nor non-Jewish. Like you take something like a company. Does a company need a mezuzah on it? It's not a Jewish-owned building. It's not a non-Jewish. It's an independent entity, I think, which you don't have discussions of this in the early halachic authorities. So I'm just curious as to why, as far as I can tell, no posek has argued this point, which to my mind seems perfectly legitimate. Okay, let's pick up now where we were last. We're getting right into the heart of this dispute, and Shlomo. One of the last things I said was that Rav Gorin, in defending himself, and we're going to see more defense, said that those who oppose him are not really, they're not poskim, they're not dayanim. He didn't say about everyone, but he said in particular about Rav Shach and the Stipor, because they led the attacks. By the way, this reminded me of something which we never did in the classes on the Musar dispute. I don't know why not, but it's in from Tnuas HaMusar, volume 2, page 78 to 77 to 78. Rav Simcha Zissel, if you remember Simcha Zissel of Kelem. So, when during the big Musar dispute, when it seemed at least from the outside that the majority of the Gedolim were opposed to the Musar movement, you know what Rav Simcha Zissel said? He said that call me anyone who didn't actually involve himself with Musar, ain't da'ato nechshevet. That is, you can't look at all these rabbis, these big gedolim who are against Musar because they never studied Musar, so their view doesn't count. He says, just like if you're asking a medical question, you can't ask someone who never studied medicine, and you can't include his opinion. If you're dealing with, let's say, the efficacy of vaccines, you can't look at people who've never studied medicine. You have to just look at the people who study. So that's what Rav Gorin was basically saying, that in matters of that you need to be a dayan for, you can't look at people who weren't dayanim. And I think the last thing I mentioned was that Rav Gorin, in his defense, said about these rabbis that they say things in general which are not based on the Shulchan Aruch. They just use rhetoric, polemics. And the example he gave is they said that Sherut Leumi is Yehari V'Yavar. And he said, so since you see that these rabbis put forth all sorts of over-the-top statements, then we can't take seriously their declarations because they use, Rav Gorin said, they use the halacha to push forth a religious agenda. And he said, I'm not doing that. I'm just saying halacha. So Shlomo asks, well, wait a second. What about the Chazon Ish? The Chazon Ish, by the way, who Rav Gorin had a great deal of admiration for and even consulted with him when he was chief chaplain of the army in the early years about halachic matters. Didn't the Chazon Ish also say that Yehari V'Yavar is that the Sherut Leumi is Yehari V'Yavar? Indeed, he did say that. And that's what I told you Rav Schechter said is Lashon Guzma, exaggeration. Whether Rav Schechter is right or not, I don't know. And By the way, it wasn't just, I'll just add to Shlomo, it wasn't just the Chazon Ish. Even Ritzi Pesach Frank signed on to this statement. And Ritzi Pesach Frank was an employee of the Israeli government. I think if Rav Gorin was asked, however, he'd say there's a distinction here. I don't know if the Chazon Ish would agree with this distinction, but I think Rav Gorin would certainly say it. The Chazon Ish was speaking about, and Ritzi Pesach Frank were speaking about Shiru Mi compulsory. Compulsory Shiru Mi. And the whole point was you can't take girls away from their homes, away from their families, and require them to be put in a certain environment and work in hospitals, things like that. Rav Gorin's not speaking about that. By the time we get to the 70s, this is voluntary, Shiru Lumi, we're speaking about. So I think Rav Gorin would say there's a great distinction, and he would say that the Chazon Ish would never say about voluntary. Now, I can't speak for the Chazon Ish one way or the other, but I think we can see there's a difference between voluntary. Because if a girl decides she wants to go work for a year at the hospital down the street, that's forbidden. But if she wants to go work at the hospital and get paid, that's permitted. For a Goran, this makes no sense. But from the Haredim, it makes sense because when she's working, she's on her own. Yes, she has a boss, but it's an independent job. She can quit if she wants. Cheryl and me, all of a sudden, you're in the Israeli government system where they can indoctrinate you into Tzionus and all the. So you see at least how they would still see it as an issue. For people who are not in the Haredi world, I have to say it strikes us as very problematic and even unimaginable to say that there's a problem with a girl volunteering to work at a hospital, but that very same girl could work at the, and that's forbidden, but that very same girl could work at the hospital and make money for it. In fact, I can tell you something that when I was in the car with Rav Soloveitchik, I don't think I've ever made this public. Rav Soloveitchik expressed, actually, no, take that back. Rav Soloveitchik, he didn't, he wouldn't talk, comment on it. The person who was driving the car was Rabbi Jachter. He tried to get Rav Soloveitchik's opinion on Shiru Lumi, and Rav Soloveitchik wouldn't comment on it. And Rabbi Jachter gave all the arguments, that you're helping people, this and that. So Rav Soloveitchik said something else. Another time I'll mention it maybe. Okay. So let us continue. Rav Gorin issued his psak. We saw the first of the attacks. But what about Rav Avadya? There was another chief rabbi, a great Torah scholar, Rav Vad Yosef. Now, the first thing we need to recognize is that Rav Vad Yosef at this time in 1973 is not the Rav Vad Yosef of 2000 or 2010. By the time, the new millennium comes around, by the 90s even, Rav Vad Yosef could say anything and do anything. He was like a recognized Godel BeYisrael that was almost untouchable. But here he's a new chief rabbi, a Talmud Chacham, and in the Ashkenazic world, he wasn't really recognized as having such authority, unlike he would years later. But it is, of course, important to see what he said. So right after Rav Gorin issues his psak, Rav Avadya is quoted in the newspaper as saying, Baruch Shepatarnu, that is, thank heavens that now we are freed from this problem. And he's quoted as saying that even though he ruled against, he's ruled that the Langer children were Mamzerim, and even though he refused to be on a Beis Din with Rav Gorin, a new Beis Din, because he said he already issued his ruling, Rav Gorin was enough of a Gadol to rule the way he did. In other words, after the fact, he accepted the Psak. And this is not an unusual situation. We mentioned it numerous times. You have one Rav or a Dayan who gives a ruling, but if another great rabbi is able to find a hechter, then the usual path is, okay, I was not able to find a hechter, but you can rely on this rabbi. He was able to give a psak. And that's, I mean, the whole system of the Batei Din in Israel works this way. I mean, that's why you have a Beis Din Erurim, an appeals court. So that is how Rav Avadya was quoted in the newspaper. And basically, this is an ex post facto bidyavad acceptance of Rav Gorin's position that he's big enough of a gadol that we can rely on him. Well, as you can imagine, as soon as this became public knowledge, the attacks on Rav Avadya started. Let me read you something here. very strong harsh attacks on Rav Avadya. Let's see. I thought I had it printed out here. Hold on a second. I want to read you something, but I don't see it. But I have it on my computer, I think. If not, I know exactly what it is I want to read you. Because of the attacks, hold on, let me see here. Yes, okay. Sorry. The attacks were such. First of all, Rav Avadya was threatened that they would burn his house. That is anonymous phone calls, things like that. We have a report that in the Hebron Yeshiva, students stopped sitting in the lunchroom with Rav Avadya's son, Rav Yitzhak Yosef, who just finished his term as chief rabbi. It's reported that the head of the Eda Charedis, Rav Yitzhak Yaakov Weiss, was ready to publicize Pashkevillim against Rav Avadya, and it's reported that Rav Chaim Shaul Karelitz, that's the nephew of the Chazon Ish, called Rav Avadya an apikoris for saying this. And there was another statement that went around saying, Chalomos Yosef, the dreams of Yosef, upitronos Shlomo, and the solutions of Shlomo, they're the same. I should note, however, that in response to these attacks on Rav Avadya, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Rav Saul Jolty, and others publicized a document defending Rav Avadya. However, in response to the attacks, Rav Avadya backtracked on his support for Rav Gorin. In fact, he even denied that he expressed support for Rav Gorin. How do we know this? Well, he writes a letter, which he then publishes numerous places, including in HaPardes, and it was written to a Rabbi Moshe Weiss of Bnei Brak. I believe Rabbi Moshe Weiss of Bnei Brak is referring to as this individual, Rabbi Moshe Tsuriel. His original name is Weiss. He's American. He's from Baltimore. He's an Eretz Yisrael guy. He unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago. I knew him. In fact, in my new book, I thank him. He was like the expert in Rav Kook. He was living in Bnei Brak at that time, and I don't know of any other Rav Moshe Weisses that maybe there is another one, but I unfortunately never asked him if he's the recipient of the letter. But it makes sense that he would be the recipient of the letter. Rav Moshe Tsuriel. In fact, in my next blog post, I begin with a bit of a memorial to Moshe Tsuriel because he really was a very significant figure in the literary scene. So what does Rav Avadya say in this letter to Rav Tsuriel? He says as follows. He says, I'm wondering how you could think, how anyone could think, I should say, that I support Rav Gorin even after the fact. Doesn't everyone know that I fought against Rav Gorin creating a new Beis Din? And although the newspapers have publicized that after the fact I basically berachti al kach and said that, finally the matter has ended, he says that's not what I meant. And don't forget, he says, I was one of the members of the Beis Din that ruled that the children are mamzerim again, but that doesn't mean anything because he could have ruled that they're mamzerim, but if Rav Gorin's able to free them, fine. But he says that's not what I meant. What I meant when I said was that thank God that Rav Gorin has ended this matter for us, that now we can put it behind us as a political thing, and we can get to work together to try to strengthen Torah and the State of Israel and the Rabbanut HaRashit, etc. But not that I was saying that it's good that it's over, that now I accept Rav Gorin's position. So what Rav Avadya was saying is that after the fact, all he wasn't saying after the fact that we can rely on what Rav Avadya said, sorry, on what Rav Gorin said, but only after the fact that now we could put it behind us and it's not going to be a machlokes between us because Rav Gorin dealt with it. But I don't agree with Rav Gorin. But in practical matters, Rav Gorin has dealt with it, so it's not going to be an issue anymore. Now we can go forward dealing with other Torah matters. Okay, that's what Rav Avadya said. The problem is that shortly after Rav Avadya's public statement in this regard, the Israeli newspapers published a picture of the Te'udah, that is the document giving permission for the Langer children to marry. They both were given permission to marry in the Tel Aviv area. And who signed it? Namely, Rav Avadia. Signature is on it. So how is it? So something doesn't make sense here. Rav Avadia claimed that he didn't know what he was signing, that they put all these papers before him, the local registrar, that he has to sign for people getting married. He doesn't look into it. The registrar examines it and comes up with it, has all these things, and then they give it to Rav Avadia. And among those were the tudah for the Langer children. But had he actually looked at the names, he would have seen there was the Langer children, and he would have said, I can't sign it. Rav Gorin has to sign it. So I understand that some people will take this with a grain of salt and think that Rav Avadia is just trying to protect himself. I don't want to weigh in one way or the other, but that's the story. Now, so we have to leave it, I think, as an open question, especially when I read you something in a minute. Did Rav Avadia in the end accept Rav Gorin's psak, not just in a practical sense, but would say that halachically, I agree that those children should not be regarded as mamzerim. You know, when Rav Avadia ran for chief rabbi, he said that, you know, the Ashkenazim, actually, before I say that, let me read you something to complicate the matters. I leave it open as an open question. Did Rav Avadia really accept it? And was his words that he wrote to Rav Tzuriyahu, Rav Weiss, just for public consumption? And you're saying, how could you say that in a Begadol Bisrael? But the fact is that even though the Torah says, Lo Saguru, don't be afraid, and even though Rav Gorin has to be admired for not backing down, the general trend is that rabbis are afraid of being destroyed. If you saw what happened to Rav Gorin, how could you not be afraid? And you have to worry about shidduchim for your children and everything. So we have plenty of examples of rabbis who do say things that publicly one way and privately they say something else. And they recognize that they can't be completely open with their views. So it is definitely possible that Rav Gorin was saying something publicly, sorry, that Rav Avadia was saying something publicly, but privately, he really would tell people that you can rely on Rav Gorin. Now, what complicates this? Well, we have a book here that, hold on a second, I want to get the right page here. I see that I didn't print out the right page. So let me, I have it over here. Okay, here it is. Pages, here, let me introduce you to a book. I don't know if you know this, anyone's seen this book. It's by Eliyahu Shitrit, and it's called Rabbeinu. And it's published in 2014. Eliyahu Shitrit was, he wasn't the secretary, he was like the assistant, I should say, of Rav Avadia. He would come to Rav Avadia's house every day and spend many hours there helping Rav Avadia get his sfarim into good shape, take the manuscripts, put them together, and he'd be working in one desk and Rav Avadia would be learning and writing another desk. And anytime Shitrit had a question, he's obviously a big Talmud Chacham, he'd speak to Rav Avadia, they'd figure out how to formulate something if it isn't clear. And he was, if you look in the introductions to Rav Avadia's Yabia Omer and other Sfarim, he always mentions Rav Eliyahu Shitrit, who put the works together for publication. This is a diary. By day, almost every day. We're not on Shabbos, but sometimes it's every day, sometimes he skips a day, of conversations he had with Rav Avadia. And he would write them down after each day. He would write them down, what Rav Avadia told him. And I want to read you something here. Hold on. I want to read you something from, it's on page 64 and 65 from Nisan of 1999. And he tells us that this is, he says, yesterday, Rabbeinu, that's Rav Avadia, was writing a tshuva to the Beis Din of Jerusalem. A tshuva, by the way, to the Beis Din, he says, of Rav Bibas. I don't know which Beis Din this was. I don't know of Rabbi Bas in Jerusalem. Rabbi Bas is, I mean, Yehuda Bibas. We speak about him in one of our trips. He was Rav of Corfu. He's one of the early proto-Zionists, a real thinker, a halachic figure also. And every time I hear the name of the Bibas children, I wonder, are they related to this great Gadol who has his, who died? He's buried in Hebron, as I recall, and there's a street named after him, one of the great early Zionists. So every time I heard the name Bibas the last year or so, I always thought that maybe they had a connection. But it says here that so he wrote a tshuva, Beheter Bat Lavo Bakal, giving permission for a girl that she has no yichus problems. And he says that I sat and we discussed it with, I discussed it with Rav Avadia, and Rav Avadia finished Pesach, and afterwards he said that on this Beis Din is Rabbi Dov Levine, that's Rav Avram Dov Levine, who wanted to be, forbid the girl. Rav Avram Dov Levine, he's a Haredi posek in Jerusalem. He's also not Beis Din now. And then he says, why did Rav Levine want to Aser the girl? Because he follows Rav Yashav. And Rabbeinu Amar li, Rav Avadia said to me that Rav Yashav mefachein milifsok b'nyanei melu. He's afraid. Rav Yashav is afraid to paskin, namely paskin lakula, lenient in these sort of yichus matters. And then he says, v'gam garam lanu tsar b'inyan parashat ha'ach ve'achot. And Rav Yashav caused us a lot of pain and difficulties in the matter of the Langer children. So, first of all, just if Mark Shapiro had published this rather than Rav Elia Shitrit, of course, I'd be attacked for revealing things that should remain private. And I don't know if Rav Avadia would want this to be made public or not, but here it is. It was made public by a Talmud Muvak of Rav Avadia, a Talmud Chaver. And, but notice what he quotes Rav Avadia saying, that Rav Yashav caused us a lot of problems, sar, difficulty. Why did he cause us difficulty? I thought Rav Avadia agreed with Rav Yashav. I thought Rav Avadia was on Rav Yashav's side the whole time. Remember, Rav Yashav was the one who encouraged Rav Avadia to run for chief rabbinate. And Rav Avadia was on the Beis Din with Rav Yashav that ruled that they were mamzerim. However, if you understand Rav Avadia's position to be that, yes, I ruled a Mamzerim, but Rav Goren, he's a big enough of a gadol that if he wants to, if he paskins that they're not, we can rely on him, then you would see why he thought that Rav Yashav caused all these problems. Because Rav Yashav is part of the group that's stating that Rav Goren has no validity as a rabbi because of what he did, and that he's lost his rabbinic authority. And, so it seems that Rav Avadia, not seems, we see from this that Rav Avadia is opposed to Rav Yashav's approach. And it can only be Rav Yashav, it's not, he's not opposed to Rav Yashav's approach ab initio, the Mamzerim. Rav Avadia is on the Beis Din. And he ruled together with Rav Yashav that they're Mamzerim. But after the fact, once Rav Goren issues his psak, it seems from this clear that Rav Avadia's original statement that Rav Goren's enough of a gadol that you can rely on him is what he really thought. Otherwise, I don't understand how you explain this passage here, his criticism of Rav Yashav. And by the way, it doesn't end at this. It goes on. Let me read you the next paragraph. Rav Avadia, all Rabbeinu, he calls him, also told me that once a man came from America with a problem mamzerus, and because he was an Ashkenazi, Rabbeinu shalach Rav Avadia sent him to Rav Yashav. What does that mean? Because he was Ashkenazi. Rav Avadia doesn't believe in this idea that there's a different psak for Ashkenazi and Sephardim. The whole thing doesn't make any sense. What it means is that the Ashkenazim didn't really hold of Rav Avadia. So therefore, if you want to make sure that you're going to get a heter, you want to make sure that the Ashkenazi Haredim hold of it, you should go to Rav Yashav. Not that Rav Avadia thought there's such a thing. I'm a big fan, by the way, of Rabbi Jachter. I read all his books, but I do have a fundamental disagreement with him, because in a number of writings he discusses halachic issues It could be anything. It could be Shemitah. It could be, he even does this with a dateline. And he says, what's the Sephardic perspective on this? And I say, absolutely, there's such thing as a Sephardic perspective on the dateline or a Sephardic perspective on Shemitah. There's no such thing. There's just one Torah. By the way, I saw in the Sefer for Avraham Shapiro, I quoted you, says the same thing. There's no such concept. Only when there's a disagreement, let's say Ramah and Shulchan Aruch. It's fine if you're a Sephardi and you, for whatever reason, you like to follow Rav Avadia, fine. But that doesn't mean that Rav Avadia's psak is not effective for Ashkenazim either. So what happens in the story? So he goes to Rav Yoshev, and Rav Yoshev didn't want to deal with it. Like Rav Avadia said, Rav Yoshev didn't want to involve himself in these Mamzerus cases. So he came back to Rabbeinu crying. Va'az Yoshev Rabbeinu v'hitiroso. And then he says, and then Rabbeinu sat and looked at it and was mad to her. And Rav Avadia says it wasn't even difficult. It wasn't a complicated case. And then, this is on Zion Nisan, the next day, Rav Eliyahu Shitrit is back again with Rav Avadia. And Rav Avadia has more to say about this. Rabbeinu hosifu daber iti hayom b'inyan ha-heter shenatan etmol b'nosei hayuchsin. He continued speaking about the heter he gave yesterday. And he said about Rav Yoshev, hu machmir me'anshei Beit Shammai. Rav Yoshev is a machmir. He's from the Beit Shammai school. They're machmir. Aval harav tzitz Eliezer v'cheni Rav Moshe Feinstein yesh lahem kocha de'etero. But he says Rav Moshe and the Rav Waldenberg, they're from what we call a Beis Hillel school. They have the power, the koach de hetera, to be mater. So this is definitely a criticism of Rav Yoshev. And I'm a little surprised that it was published here, unless this is a reflection of towards the end, there was basically a falling out between Rav Yoshev's people and Rav Avadia. So for instance, if you know the story, Rav Yoshev and his people engineered this chief rabbi, so-called chief rabbi, Yonah Metzger, becoming chief rabbi of the state of Israel. By the way, unfortunately, he's in the news again for something. I hope it's not true. And the whole point was that, well, they wanted to destroy the chief rabbinate and just have a functionary, but they also wanted to make sure the Heter Mechira was not instituted. And Rav Avadia, who's a big backer of the Heter Mechira, he had to do the Heter Mechira. I think it was Rabakshi Doron then, in his house, because it was not an official government thing, because the other chief rabbi didn't agree. And then later you had the issue with the army conversions, where Rav Yoshe's followers, they started voiding conversions, and they voided Rav Druckman's conversions, and the army conversions they said were no good. So Rav Amar went to Rav Avadia, and Rav Avadia writes a letter affirming all the army conversions. Basically, his attitude was that maybe they were too liberal and lenient on the army conversions, but after the fact, all these conversions are valid. So and there were attacks on Rav Avadia. So this could be a reflection of why Rabbi Shitrit decides to publicize this to let people know that we don't need to shiver in our feet, or we don't need to be concerned with what the Ashkenazi Haredim say about this, because Rav Avadia is greater than them. This idea, incidentally, of Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, where does this come from? Well, actually, this is an old theme of Rav Avadia. And he brought down the attacks of the B'nai B'rak crowd on him, because when he was running for chief rabbi, he said that he will, there's something a little bit distasteful, but as they're running for chief rabbi, they need to get votes. And they don't just need to get the votes of the rabbis, they also need to get the votes of the mayors, etc. Rav Avadia was advocating what he said, that he would have a user-friendly, let's say, halacha. He said that we, Sfardim, follow in the school of Beis Hillel. And the Ashkenazim, they follow Beis Shammai. They're more machmir. And he says, I will follow the school of Beis Hillel. And of course, the people in the Ashkenazi Haredim were quite offended by this. I don't know why the Ashkenazi Dati Lumi weren't offended, but I would see, think they could be offended also. Because what do you mean? Ashkenazim are Beis Shammai? But that's what he said. Now, What people didn't realize is that this wasn't original to Rav Avadya. Rav Avadya was actually quoting the Chida, Rav Chaim Yosef David Azoulay, the great Chida from the 18th century. In fact, before Rav Avadya, the only Sephardic rabbi referred to as just two Sephardic rabbis were referred to as Maran. Maran is a term that's used. It means like the ultimate. These days, everyone is a Gaon. So who's above the Gaon? Maran. If you look in the Haredi newspapers, Maran means like the Pope, I guess. It's the ultimate, the highest authority. I don't want to use the word Pope, but I mean that's fundamentally that's what it is, because like no one can dispute with if he's Maran. It's often understood that he's the last word. And even today, you have a bunch of Marans. You can even have more than one Maran. There was a time where you just had like one Maran. Rav Shach was Maran, and Rav Stiper was, let's say Rav Eliashiv was Maran. Now I think you can have a bunch of Marans even in the same group, so it doesn't even have the same. You have to come up with a new title, maybe Rosh Kol B'nei Agola or whatever it is. But incidentally, if you look carefully, look in Rav Vadia, he distinguishes when it's a really great rabbi, it's Hagaon. Let's say Hagaon Rav Moshe Feinstein. If it's just a second level rabbi, it's Harav HaGaon. So Hagaon Harav, you put the stress on the Gaon. Harav HaGaon, the stress is on the Rav. Check out Rav Avadya's writings. You'll see this. All the top level rabbis, it's Hagaon Rav, and the second level rabbis, it's Rav HaGaon. But so the Chida was the only, the Shulchan Aruch was always called Maran, Yosef Karo. The Chida was the only other one until modern times, I think, till Rav Avadya Yosef, to be called Maran. That was the Chida. So it was very, very important authority. And the Chida said this. I'll read you what the Chida says now. We can see this in Meir Ben Yehuda's book on the Chida, page 165. He says, he doesn't actually say Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, but it's the same point. He quotes this in this book. He quotes the Chida, who's quoting. He begins the paragraph by saying that the Chida's relationship to the Ashkenazim was Bayati. I mean, his mother was Ashkenazi, but let's see. So he cites another rabbi, an Italian rabbi, who says as follows: the Sfardim, they come from the side, speaking Kabbalistically, of Chesed. And the Ashkenazim, they come from Gevurah. That is, the Sfardim are kind and they are gentle and they are amenable, and the Ashkenazim are Gevurah. They're strong, they're firm, they're strict. And because the Ashkenazim come from Gevurah, what are they? They're Machmirim Bedinim Kemidas Gevurah. The Sfardim, they're Mekilim because they're Chesed. So Rav Avadya's point was that the Ashkenazim always like to be Machmir. They're like Beis Shammai, and the Sfardim are Mako like Beis Hillel. Okay, let us move on from Rav Avadya. Now, I just want to say though about Ashkenazim and Sfardim. Getting back to this book again by Rav Avraham Shapiro, he says on page 368 that a Dayan who doesn't know Ktzos HaChoshen Toa B'dvar Mishnah. He's making a basic error. And if he doesn't know the Nesivos, Toa B'shikul Das. He makes an error, obvious, like logical error. So my question is for Rav Avraham Shapiro is, what about all these Sfardi Dayanim who, because in their background, they studied Choshen Mishpat and they study the Sephardic commentaries, they never studied the Ketzos and they never studied the Nesivos. So they're not reliable Dayanim? Maybe he thought so. I can tell you, because Rabbi Mark Angel reports this, that Rav Avram Shapiro was a machmir on conversions. He was chief rabbi. He's going to play part of our story in the Langer case as well. So Rav Mark Angel reports that he said to him, well, what about Rav Uziel? Rav Uziel was very lenient, liberal on conversions. You don't have to be completely observant. And Rav Avraham Shapiro said as follows, and he's saying this about someone he knew, Rav Uziel, and someone who was official chief rabbi, saying that he said that he's not such a great posek, that he's not. Rabbi Mark Angel wrote his article saying obviously how offended he was and saw this as Ashkenazic central centrism, I guess, focusing only on what the Ashkenazic posts came. He also mentions, I think it might be the same article, Rabbi Angel, because it was the visit that Rav Avram Shapiro only came to America one time, as far as I recall, or maybe a second, but I think only once. And he came with a Mordechai Eliyahu. And Rabbi Angel said to Mordechai, came to Mordechai Eliyahu, he described this in the article. If it was, maybe it was this visit or the next time, Mordechai Eliyahu came a lot. And he said, how come all the Sephardic yeshiva students today dress Ashkenazic in black and white? That's not our tradition. We don't dress that way. And Rav Mordechai Eliyahu said, but today that's how yeshiva students dress. So Rabbi Mark Angel, as you can imagine, was not very happy with that answer. He wanted Rav Mordechai Eliyahu to say, you're right, they shouldn't dress that way. We began with the Haredi response, and let's continue. Because the Haredi response is unprecedented. In fact, let me read you before I get to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, because the Lubavitcher Rebbe has a long piece. But let me first get to you with the Lithuanian Haredim, the Litvisha. There was a big Haredi protest in Bnei Brak, and of course, the people you'd expect spoke, including Rav Shach. I already told you that Yair HaLevi, in his dissertation, forthcoming book, makes the case that Rav Shach comes to fame and leadership because of his role in the Langer dispute. And I want to read you what he says here. This is in Michtavim u'Ma'amarim, Volume 1, 1 to 2, they call it, page 73 and on. And Divrei Za'akad Neged Heter Pesulei Kal. That is the cry of of what Rav Gorin did. And he begins saying, I did not come here to this gathering to give a speech, but to cry out from my heart. And in this, he talks about, he compares it to a Sefer Torah that's burnt. And then he says, there are those who say that Rav Gorin is a. And by the way, at this time, Rav Gorin has not defended his position. Rav Gorin would later say he made a big mistake. He should have published his Sefer. We're going chronological, but that's why we haven't got to the Sefer. But Rav Gorin said he should have published the Sefer and then issued the Psak. Instead, he issues a Psak, and the attacks right now on him, they have no idea on what basis Rav Gorin is deciding. Now, it's true, Rav Gorin did have a little booklet he sent out, but that's very different than his what, almost 200-page book. And most people hadn't seen that booklet. I could tell you, some of them say we never saw it, but they say we don't need to see it because we know it can't be authentic halacha. So all the things we're seeing now are just based on the fact that Rav Gorin's elected chief rabbi, and immediately he creates this beis din and frees them. So Rav Shach says there are those who say that Rav Gorin is a lamdan, but he says, what does it mean to be a lamdan? Now Rav Gorin, of course, was a lamdan. He did like seven blot a day since he was young. He tried to at least. He wrote his first sefer when he's 17 years old. Everyone knows he's a lamdan. No one can take that away from him. Not just a lamdan, an unbelievable lamdan. But he says, Rav Shach says, what does it mean to be a lamdan? He says, they say in the name of the Beis HaLevi that a lamdan is not one who knows how to learn. Just like a ganav is not someone who knows how to steal. You're not a ganav just because you know how to steal. You have to steal to be a ganav. So a lamdan is not just one who knows how to learn, but it has to be one halomeg Torah beyira shamayim tsurufa godemus lamdan. This is a yikare. That's what a lamdan is. So a lamdan is one not just who knows how to learn, and not even one who learns, but one who learns with yiras shamayim, and yiras shamayim goes before his chachma, his wisdom. So this is an unbelievable attack on Rav Gorin. You're saying Rav Gorin doesn't have Yiras Shamayim here. And it doesn't, he might know a lot, but all sorts of people can know a lot. That doesn't make them a lamdan. And he says, that's why we've come here. Because we have to uproot from everyone's thinking that he's a reliable figure. And the answer is no. Who eino Rav? We are here to let you know that Rav Gorin is not to be regarded as a rabbi, and his psakim are not to be regarded as psak. You cannot rely on his hashkacha, and his place is outside our camp. If the Mamzerim are permitted to enter the Kahal, he is forbidden to come to the Kahal. In other words, if Rav Gordon is going to tell us that these Mamzerim are mutar, then he that they can come in, then he has to be out. The only way Rav Gordon can be part of our community if he retracts his psak, and as long as he asserts that, he is not only is he that, he goes further. He says, Garua hu mehareformim. Rav Shach says that Rav Gorin is worse than the reformers. Why is he worse than the reformers? Because he can do much damage. Everyone knows the reformers. No one pays attention to them. But he, hallo, Rav HaRashihu kivyachol. He's the chief rabbi. So people take him seriously. So he's worse than the reformers. And then Rav Shach goes on and says that this isn't something that just happened recently. This is something that's been going on for a while with Rav Gorin. And then he says, and he, Rav Gorin says that he published, that he wrote a kuntras. Remember, he hasn't published it yet, but Rav Gorin said when he was matur, he says he has a whole book about this. And Rav Shach says that those who've seen it say that this kuntras is only like sonos bobulim ushkarim, that it's just, it's a joke. It's falsehoods. Rav Shach never saw it. But he says that people who have seen it have said it's a joke. Look, you can't get much stronger than that. And can you blame the Haredi were so offended when Rav Gorin responded to Rav Shach, who made you halakhic authority for all of Israel? And the attack on Rav Shach that I mentioned last class, that he distorts halacha to say things like "Sheru l'mi is yahag v'yavar," but look what Rav Shach said. You can't get any worse. Say worse about someone than saying that he's a reformer. We don't see this sort of language in the other statements as strong, although we will see very strong. By the way, this is but Rav Shach. This is why he became the leader, because he spoke publicly and he spoke in such a strong, harsh, take no prisoners sort of way. And someone who's quieter, who's into compromises, more moderate, they're never going to get the masses backing. The masses, who are riled up, they follow such a leader. In fact, the very next page, very next siman in this book is talking his it's an attack against the Datiim Leumim and the half agudists. And he talks about how nothing good, if anything good ever comes out of B'nai Akiva Yeshiva, it's because the person later went to a Haredi Yeshiva. And then he says that he speaks about the half Agudistan. Those are like the Poway Agudas Yisrael. They observe Torah, yes, but they also add Zionism. And then he says, I don't need to be firmer than the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish never made a Suda on Heiyar. And he never said hello. And therefore, I don't need to be more pious than the Chazon Ish. And if he didn't recognize this as an important day, I don't need to do it. And if there was a need to do it, the Chazon Ish would have done it. And he goes on to say that, there's a shituf. We know the term shituf. We spoke about Christianity. Shituf, you take God, but you also combine it with something else. He says that the Zionists do shituf because they have Zionism and Torah, so we have to uproot the shituf and whatever. So, but we understand that's Rosh Hashanah. The stipur was older than Rosh Hashanah. In fact, the stipur really brought, I would say, Rosh Hashanah into the Haredi leadership because the stipur has Rosh Hashanah's sign on a lot of his public statements. The stipur wasn't really naturally that sort of leader, so he started asking Rav Shach to sign on his statements. And the stipur, who was also a great lamdin, but not a posek in the classical sense, he's not a dayan, but he says about he compares Rav Gorin with Aaron Chorin. And if you recall our classes on reform, Aaron Chorin was the first one of the early reform leaders. He was a rabbi, a Talmud Chacham, a student of the Rebbe Yehuda, and They're not going to compare Rav Gorin to Geiger because Rav Gorin is clearly not a reformer, but he looks like a rabbi. He writes like a rabbi. So who is he? He's Horin, Aaron Horin, who fooled everyone to think he was a real pious Talmid Chacham when only later on we saw the truth. The Yedda Charedit has a large gathering where everyone does Kriya. It's amazing. The Yedda Charedit. The Yedda Charedit doesn't even accept the chief rabbinate. They don't care about the chief rabbinate Batei Din. They have nothing to do with them. What are they? They never thought that the Batei Din of the chief rabbinate, even when Rav Yoshev was on it, that this was a legitimate Beis Din. And yet they got into it also, and they have a gathering where everyone does Kriya. Yair HaLevi, in his dissertation, says that as far as he knows, this is unprecedented in the Jewish history to call everyone together to do Kriya. He says, even during the Holocaust, there was never a public gathering of all the people to do Kriya. What's funny is Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Weiss, the Baal Minchas Yitzchak, the head of the head rabbinic head of the Yedda Charedit, is part of our story because Rav Gorin, as we'll see later, is going to claim that the Minchas Yitzchak actually agreed with him, that Rav Gorin sent this tshuva to the Minchas Yitzchak. And in the book, Rav Gorin cites the Minchas Yitzchak as a support for him. So we'll get to that. Rav Yechiel Michel Feinstein, let me show you this individual. Yechiel Michel Feinstein, nephew of Ramosha Feinstein, son-in-law of the Brisker Rav, he makes his way to America before during the war. He went to he was in Vilna. It says you can read the whole thing here. He made his way to Japan, and then he came to with Sugi Haraviza, and he makes his way to America. And do you know where he teaches? Boston. Rav Soloveitchik had a yeshiva called Heichal Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi in Boston for a few years. Actually, it says it here, Heichal Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi. And he taught for Rav Soloveitchik in Boston. And when they came out with a biography about him a few years ago, and I, this is like the real Haredi world. And I really wanted to see, would they cover this up, that he was in Boston? And but they didn't. They have it there. And then he went and he taught at Masifta Tiferes Yerushalayim with Rav Moshe, and he was a Haredi leader of he had some followers. He wasn't such an important person in the political scene. Obviously, a great Talmid Chacham. He said that we can't even respond to Rav Gorin. He said that to even respond to his psak gives it legitimacy, because then all of a sudden it's a machlokes. This rabbi says this, the other rabbi says that. He says we simply have to say what he says is completely false. End of story. Not debate halachically. We've seen this before. Rav Chaim Ozer thought that when it came to electricity on Shabbos and Yom Tov, we shouldn't debate it. Actually, Yom Tov, I think Yom Tov also. He said, don't debate it, just say it's usher. He said about to Rechi Yaakov Weinberg, we can't write a tshuva about stunning animals before Shlita and publish it, because even if you conclude it's forbidden, because then it becomes an issue with debate, and people will say, well, then there must be, if you're being machmir, but there's also a tzad v'hakel, just paskin no. Apparently that was the view of Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector, in certain areas as well. Rav Yechiel Michel Feinstein says that he says that people have made a big mistake. They're using the phrase kocha de tera odif, which appears in the Gemara, that the ability to be matter something is superior. They were using it as a value judgment. That is, if you have two poskim and one posek is mekel, then he's the one you should prefer. He's the better one. And Rav Feinstein says that's not what it means. All it means, and if you look in Rashi, that's how Rashi explains in the Gemara. All it means is that anyone could be machmir. To be machmir doesn't require anything; you just say forbidden. But to be mekel, it requires strength. So the person who's going to be permit something, he has to have strength. So in that sense, kocha de tera adif, that it's more powerful, the kocha de tera, because to permit something, it's a lot harder than to forbid. Forbidding just means they don't do it. And I think historically what he's saying is correct, even though we find even Talmid Chachamim who sometimes use it the other way, that you should prefer the Mako view, because the Mako view, we don't want to put pressure on the people, etc. But that's not what Kocha d'Etera. If you want to make a different argument and say prefer Kikuas because we don't need to make people spend money, we've seen that we Torah's Chasal Mamonu Yisrael, that you can make all sorts of arguments why you should prefer the lenient view. But the expression Kocha d'Etera Adif, as far as I can see, doesn't mean that. Okay, we will stop here now. There's more condemnations to come, I hate to say it, including the Lubavitcher Rebbe, because the Lubavitcher Rebbe at least two times goes into detail in his talks, his from Rangins, against Rav Gorin. But then we will end with that. I'll tell you some interesting things from Rav Moshe, and then we're going to see, and hopefully we'll begin next week, Rav Gorin publishes his psak. And we've been dealing right now with the last few weeks with history. Some of you might say hak, that term, the stuff that all yeshiva guys like to speak about, the conflicts between the rabbis, and that's what we've been doing the last few weeks. But next week, hopefully, we will get into the meat of the matter, the halachic dispute. What is the basis for declaring these kids mamzerim, and what is the basis for muttering them? And we will go through all the arguments. It's not one argument. Rav Gorin builds argument upon argument, and I think in the end you'll come out feeling very surprised how this became such a controversy. And I think you'll all agree, even if you're not fans of Rav Gorin, that if Rav Moshe Feinstein had issued this psak, or if Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, there wouldn't have been such a. I don't think there would have been any controversy. But even if there was some controversy, because even from Moshe there was controversy. But there's controversy, and then there's calling a rabbi a reform rabbi, an acher, over the top. I think we'll all have to conclude that it's because what they viewed as Rav Gorin's vision of a new type of Eretz Yisrael type of halacha and his actions for years, that's why they responded so harshly. We shall see. So let me take some questions here. Someone privately asked me to tell the anecdote for Soloveitchik. I've told it to. I don't think I can say it because it's a family thing. I shouldn't have said it privately. Maybe one day, if you meet me, Shmuel, I can tell you. But publicly, to put it on, I don't feel comfortable. Heter Mechira. Oh, I said Heter Mechira is to sell the land during the sabbatical year. That they were coming up a couple of years, I guess, to a sabbatical year. They sell all the land so that you can work the land, because Jews are not allowed to work the land during a sabbatical year. So Rav Avadia Yosef was a big backer of selling the land during a sabbatical year so that Jews can have parnasa, and that you don't support the Arabs. In fact, there's a video of him in which his grandson asks him about this. And since the Haredim, Ashkenazi Haredim from the beginning, have been very opposed to it, they made it basic to their ch chief rabbi, whoever they put in, he would not accept the Heter Mechira. Okay, Jack, you're ready for the meat of the matter. We hope we'll get it next time, because you want to see the halacha. I get it. I didn't know, but you know what? You really can't understand the story without knowing everything else we've seen, because if you just look at the halacha, no one would be think this is as controversial. I mean, Rav Gorin builds a case, and in cases of Mamzerus, we're told that you always have to look, you have to stretch as far as you can, bend over backwards to try to find a heter. I can give you some heteri, maybe I will give you from Poskim the things they said that to be free of Mamzer. How they bent over so much, and but because that's what Chazal tell us, that we have to do that for an aguna and for a mamzer. And also everything we've been seeing, it's uncomfortable and it's difficult to listen to, but it's part of Jewish history. So we're not covering it up here. Okay, that is it for
That's
today.
That's, of course, where Rabbi Schwab was against the study of Jewish history. That's, I'm sure people know. I don't know, maybe people don't. Rabbi Schwab, Shimon Schwab from the Boris community, you know, in J.J. Schechter's wonderful article many years ago on the closing of Volozhin Yeshiva. So the standard line is, you know, because they didn't want any secular studies, and Rabbi Schechter shows that, of course, isn't true at all. And he describes that, as Rav Schwab said, that we can't study history because history has to be truthful, and the truth often hurts. And why do people have to know? But he said we can never falsify history. Unfortunately, today, that's a different story. But I was going to, okay, that's, and then, of course, tomorrow, sort of on a different slant, Adam Mintz, of course, is continuing his series on conversion. Tomorrow he's discussing the Denver Beit Din. I don't know if people are familiar with the Denver Beit Din. I'm just curious, a show of hands. This was, lots of people. Okay, good. So, if you are familiar, you should come to hear his perspective. If you aren't familiar, all the more reason to come to find out. But that was Beit Din convened for, I don't know, 7-8 years, the late 70s to the mid 80s, and Denver Orthodox and Conservative and Reform rabbis did hundreds of conversions. So that will be, and I remember I was in the Griscola when the whole thing broke and it fell apart, and we asked Rev Lichtenstein about it and what he thought. So that's another discussion. And okay. And Rabbi Shulman, that's at 11 a.m. tomorrow. And then Rabbi Shulman continues his class on Sefer Yoshua tomorrow, and then all our regular classes throughout the week. Okay, we look forward to learning with you. Look forward to hear good things. And everybody should be well. And okay, and Laila Tov and Besorot Tovot. And please invite a friend to join us. And thank you, Dr. Mark. Okay, Laila Tov.
Well, next week.
Have a good night. Be well.
Good night, everybody.